MacCast, Sunday, August 9th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode of Mac and Apple news, information, great stuff, tips, tricks, all that kind of, all those things we get into here on the MacCast. Struggling a little bit today with the opening, but that's okay. Hey, glad to be here with you. We have some great things to get into, including some great numbers from Apple that we haven't talked about yet. You might know about some of these, but they gave their quarterly results. We're going to get into those. We've got new Macs in the lineup to talk about, some exciting information there. Of course, we're going to get into the latest rumors, a little bit of a shakeup in the executive level of Apple to talk about this week. Going to talk about new features for Apple Watch, updates to how you might buy products at Apple. We're going to get into some Apple TV Plus stuff. Also, a little security issue that cropped up this week, and do you need to be concerned about it or not? We'll get into that. So that's all in the news. And then for feedback, I've got a little Easter egg for you that you may have not seen yet. We're going to talk about how to save and archive your messages. We're going to get into how to secure and hide folders and information on your Mac, and we'll round out with a question about how you might go about remotely launching apps on a Mac from an iOS device. And can you do that? How can you do that? And what are some options there? So we're going to get into all of that. It should be a great episode. Stay tuned. But before we jump in, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor. And that is CashFly. We love CashFly here on the MacCast because they are the folks that bring this podcast to you. The reality is without them, you wouldn't be hearing this show right now. They make sure that these episodes get out to you as quickly and reliably as possible, and that is something they want to help do for your website and your business. When websites don't load, people lose interest. For as a matter of fact, for every second a page takes to load, it costs the company about 16% in engagement, and of course, fewer visits to your site means fewer customers, and that is not good for anyone. Well, CashFly has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content can be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any additional development work from you. And with the recent addition of their flexible Edge application platform and integration services, their capabilities reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. CashFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving your content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know that it is, optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all of your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using. And the good people at CashFly, they're going to provide you with a free optimization consultation just for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. You can know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report and learn how CashFly's web optimization solutions can help you add 60 points to your score instantly. Just visit mac.cashfly.com, that's mac.cashefly.com now to get that free report and learn how CashFly's web optimization solutions can help you. And a big thank you to CashFly for their support of the podcast. About a week or so ago, Apple came out with their latest quarterly numbers, and while many of us might have thought it would have been a little bit rough given the current situation in the world, it actually turned out to be gangbusters. Apple actually had a record quarter with double-digit growth in products and services. They earned revenue of $59.7 billion and profits of $11.25 billion. The way it broke down by category was $26.42 billion for iPhone. That was up about 1.66% year over year. $13.6 billion in services, up almost 15% year over year. About $7 billion in Mac sales, up almost 22% year over year, which is incredible. 6.58 billion in iPad sales, that's up 31% year over year, and 6.45 billion in wearables, home and accessories, up 16.74% year over year. So up on everything across the board, every category, which was just incredible. International sales accounted for 60% of that revenue, so Apple doing very well internationally. And of particular but not surprising interest, of course, are those Mac and iPad sales. And I say not surprising because turns out what was going on is a lot of folks working from home, a lot of students and families needing to work at home away from school. That means you're looking at your technology that's sitting around your house and going, yeah, I probably actually need a new iMac, or maybe I need a second Mac or an iPad for my kids to be able to do their work. So that turned out to be good for Apple's numbers. What was surprising even to Apple, though, was that small growth in iPhone revenue. Tim Cook attributed the success of that to lower cost iPhone SE sales. The update to that helped Apple out a lot. He said along with the stimulus package that folks received, they bought iPhones, I guess, is also along with other Mac technology or Apple technology. And that was in the face of a global smartphone market that was actually in decline, down 14% in the second quarter of 2020, at least according to the latest research from Canalys. They report that Apple was actually the only company to grow in the quarter, with their shipments up 25% year over year, and that was obviously reflected in that additional iPhone revenue that Apple reported. Apple did note that despite all the great success in online sales and all these great numbers, though, the fact that they're not able to keep their retail stores open has had an impact on their numbers, and it will continue to have an impact while we've got this pandemic going on. But overall, a really great quarter for Apple. They did kind of give guidance, not specific guidance, but said, you know, next quarter, we really don't know what's going to happen. So overall, it's looking really positive, but, you know, we're going to have to wait and see what happens in the next fiscal quarter. And Apple's quarterly numbers weren't the only exciting thing that happened over the last week or so. Another exciting thing that happened is we finally got a updated Mac. As expected, Apple did come out with some updates to their iMac line. These are probably the last, I would imagine, Intel updates for the iMac line, but wow, did they do a great job of pushing at least the 27-inch Mac forward. What didn't happen, though, is we didn't get a redesigned version of the iMac. That was in the rumors, and it's looking now like that'll probably be the first reserved for the first edition of a Apple Silicon iMac. Speaking to this new updated iMac line, though, they did, as I say, make impressive updates. The new version comes with the latest 10th generation Intel Core processors, and you have options of 6, 8, or even now 10 cores, bringing it right up there with the iMac Pro. They added new graphics as well, AMD Radeon Pro Series 5000 graphics, and you can now upgrade the RAM up to 128 gigabytes, and luckily the 27-inch iMac stays still consumer upgradable with the RAM, so you can put your own RAM in. You don't have to buy it directly from Apple. They still have the little door on the back. This year's iMac also brings the T2 security chip to the 27-inch model, and all models are SSDs, so they got rid of the old spinning and fusion drive options, and you can get SSD storage sizes up to 8 terabytes. And in a shocking surprise, guess what? The FaceTime camera is now 1080p, no more 720p. Finally, we get a decent camera on a Mac. I just wish they would have done that to the laptops. I have the 16-inch MacBook Pro, and I have no idea why it's taken them so long to put a 1080p camera in a Mac. But there you have it. It's in the iMac. And they also updated the microphones to those new studio quality microphone system, just like the one that's in the 16-inch MacBook Pro. And In a surprise option, they added the ability, if you want, on that 5K display, that 27-inch display, to get the nano texture glass, just like they have on the Apple Pro Display XDR. And unlike the Pro Display, it won't cost you $1,000 as an add-on. It will be $500 US. Unfortunately, just like the Pro Display, Apple also says that if you go with that option, you will need to use the special cloth that's included as the only cloth to clean the display. They advise that you do not clean the display with anything other than the Apple cloth, and that you do not use water to clean the display. If liquid is needed, Apple says you need to use their cloth with a 70% isopropyl alcohol solution. And if you lose that cloth, you're going to have to get a new one from Apple. They can be ordered for around $9 US each. So that nano texture, I guess, is very delicate, and you got to be very careful with it. So if you do opt for that option, but it's beautiful. It gives you a really nice matte textured display with very diffuse light. And if you're a professional, that's probably something that you're going to want to opt for. Prices are great, starting at $1,799 US, and that'll get you a 27-inch model with a 6-core CPU. Again, that 10th generation Intel, 8 gigabytes of RAM, the Radeon Pro 5300 GPU, and a 256 gigabyte SSD. So great starting prices, great options, and you can configure the heck out of that thing. It's looking like, depending upon what your needs are, if you spec it out pretty close to the base model iMac Pro, it gets a little bit hard to justify spending the money on the iMac Pro, considering the iMac Pro has a now 3-year-old processor. So you're getting more modern processors. There's some slight advantages depending upon what your use cases are, but the 27-inch iMac is looking like a really great option at this time. Now, of course, the only dilemma is we do know that Apple is moving to Apple Silicon over the next 2 years, and so if you want to hold out for that, you probably want to skip this model iMac. But if you're in the market for an iMac right now, this looks like a really great option. And it's fast. The specs show that you get up to 65% faster performance in the CPU, up to 55% faster graphics, and it's a really great choice. I just, having recently purchased a Mac, I had wanted to go for a desktop. I couldn't get an iMac in the time that I needed it, so I opted for the laptop. But man, if these were around, I would have been very, very tempted to go with one of these models. On the 21.5-inch models, they also got an update, but I have to say it's disappointing at best. They're finally SSDs across the line. You can still order options with Fusion drives, but that's about it for the 21.5-inch model. I think Apple kind of signaling that, you know, that one is really end of life and they're not really going to do much with it. So you don't get those great CPU upgrades. You don't get any of that other stuff. But nice to see them at the very least going full SSD, which I think they should have gone to a long time ago. And getting back to that iMac Pro, it also did get a sort of CPU bump. The base configuration now comes with a 10-core 3.0 gigahertz Xeon W chip, which was previously an upgrade option. So they kind of kicked that down in the line. You now get that 10-core with the base model, which is nice considering that, you know, that's the maxed out option on the new 27-inch iMac. And like I said, you can kind of configure the things to similarly, and you can see that the new iMac is, you know, it's going to be hard to justify that base model iMac Pro if you don't need all of those Pro features. So some great new Macs, or iMacs rather, in the lineup. Of course, we're expecting Apple to upgrade other models. Probably the next thing we might see is Apple's first Apple Silicon-based Mac, and many are kind of pointing toward the MacBook Air as being the first model that we would see get that. There was kind of some batteries that surfaced this week that looked like they might be destined for that model, so it could be right around the corner. Apple, you know, is expected to put out a couple models before the end of the year, or at least maybe one more model before the end of the year, and that could be it. The other thing that happened this past week is Apple did release the first public beta of Mac OS Big Sur, their next version of the operating system, the first version of Mac OS to go to 11.0. So we're finally through the 10s and on to 11. It's looking exciting. A lot of reviewers and folks picking it up. Just saying, though, it's really not ready for prime time. It is a beta. So as tempting as it might be for many of you to maybe jump in on the public beta, I would really advise most people doing that unless they're going to run it on an alternate system, or maybe you'll set up a dual boot situation, boot from an external drive just to play with it. But I would avoid putting it on your main system. People have asked me if I would do that, but I already know that a lot of the audio apps that I use, specifically ones from Rogue Amoeba, are not Big Sur compatible yet. So that's the kind of thing you don't want to run into. You don't want to upgrade your machine to a public beta and then find out you can't run your critical software. So don't get tempted, as nice as it might be. You know, just wait for the official release. It's only a couple more months and we can all be running Big Sur. It's got some great features, and I know a lot of us are sort of hot to try them out, but yeah, save yourself some heartache, again, unless you're going to do it on some alternate system. But that's kind of the latest updates in the Mac side of the Apple news this week. Moving on to iPhone and iPhone 12, something Apple did confirm during their quarterly results call, which is a little bit unusual for Apple, was that this year's iPhone updates are going to be, quote, a few weeks late. We had been getting a lot of rumors seeming to indicate that Apple might have to push back the launch of the iPhone 12 this year, and Apple did, in a way, confirm that. Last year, Apple started selling iPhones, if you remember, in late September, and so depending upon what Apple's definition of a few weeks late is, I'm suspecting we could see iPhones arriving mid to late October, and maybe some even pushing into November. Of course, this year we're expecting a four-model lineup with two size options for the iPhone 12, a 5.4-inch and a 6.1-inch model, and then two iPhone 12 Pro models, the 6.1-inch iPhone 12 Pro and the 6.7-inch iPhone 12 Pro Max. As far as some of the differences, they're all expected to have OLED displays, and it's expected that the Pro models are going to have bigger updates to the camera systems, including those that new LiDAR scanner technology that was released in the latest iPad Pro updates. As far as the launch schedule, I would not be surprised if we saw a staggered release for the different models. Apple has done this in the past, and there's some recent rumors suggesting that the two 6.1-inch models could come first, followed by the 5.4-inch and the 6.7-inch models a few weeks later. Now, Ming-Chi Kuo noted recently that one of Apple's camera suppliers was having some trouble with the coatings on the wide-angle lenses. In testing, they were becoming cracked, although he did say that that's not likely to impact the timeline. But what's interesting is in that same report, he talked about this staggered release and seemed to indicate that production of the 5.4-inch and the lower-end 6.1-inch iPhone 12 models were proceeding simultaneously. So with his indications, it would seem like the iPhone 12 might launch first, followed by then the iPhone 12 Pro models. And that release schedule seems to make a little bit more sense to me. It's something that Apple has done in the past. I don't know why they would release kind of, you know, one iPhone 12 and one iPhone 12 Pro model at the same time and then move to the other sizes, unless the idea there would be that certain consumers are going to want the 12 in versus the 12 Pro, and then they would actually have kind of a model out at the same time to serve each market. But it feels better to me to kind of release one version, the 12, and then the Pro later. And again, they've done that historically, so I'm putting my money on that happening and not going the other way around. The other thing that's happening with iPhones now, of course, is that we're starting to see more frequent component leaks as suppliers are getting stock ready and components ready to go to assembly. The Weibo had, or Weibo or Weibo, I can never remember, the Chinese site reportedly had some images of a circular array of 36 magnets that would be inside the back case of this year's iPhone. They look like they're something for wireless charging, mounting, or alignment to kind of get things better aligned, you know, when you try to put that on the charging mat. Although it could be for some kind of new feature that Apple's looking to do, maybe even possibly Apple's own charging system. Although those rumors to me feel a little bit further out there in terms of validity. I think it's more just about better alignment of the charging puck. The other thing that we saw leaked this past week was an iPhone, what was reported to be an iPhone 12 display unit. It was hard to tell which exact model it was from, but many people believed it was the 5.4-inch iPhone 12 model. The only thing of note there was it did have a reoriented display connector coming from the bottom rather than the side. And the other thing that they noted was that the notch for the true depth camera system seemed to be about the same size as the current model. So we had heard some rumors that Apple might be trying to trim that down a little bit, but it's sounding like it's going to stay the same in this year's iPhone 12 lineup. And I don't know about you, but the notch doesn't really bother me much anymore. I think we've all kind of gotten used to it, and really, it's more or less invisible at this point. But that's sort of the latest for iPhone 12, really, just the fact that we know the launch is going to be a little bit later this year for obvious reasons. Here's a little bit of surprise news I don't think anyone saw coming. We didn't hear rumors about this, and we've had other executive shakeups at Apple that we have heard rumors on. If you remember, before Johnny Ive sort of retired or stepped down from his major role at the company, we heard a lot of rumors that that might be happening. This time around, we hear that Phil Schiller is stepping down from his role as Senior Vice President of Worldwide Marketing to become an Apple Fellow. His partner, Greg Joswiak, will be stepping into the Senior VP of Worldwide Marketing role. Jos, as you might know, has served as Vice President of Worldwide Product Marketing. So basically, his role is being expanded to cover all of the marketing from within Apple, not just for product marketing. Schiller is going to still be involved at Apple. I guess that's what being a fellow means. He'll be reporting still directly to Tim Cook, but his roles are definitely going to be different. Schiller will be continuing to lead the App Store and Apple events, so he's still going to kind of be in charge of the App Store and all the app review process and all those sorts of things. And then Tim Cook says he's also going to quote, provide thought partnership and guidance for Apple. So it sounds like he's taking on more of a consulting style role along with his previous duties of sort of running the Apple Store and Apple events. Schiller noted that he wants to remain at Apple as long as they will have him, but that he's backing away from his existing role to make more time in the future for family, friends, and personal projects. I think it'll be real interesting to see what kinds of personal projects he gets into, and I'm sure we'll hear news about that in the future. But I'm sure everybody is a little bit sad to see Phil go. He's been a great executive at Apple, brought us a lot of entertainment over the years in the keynotes, and he's definitely going to be missed. Again, not gone, but just taking a sort of smaller role there at Apple. It's looking more and more like the next generation of Apple Watch could finally bring blood oxygen monitoring to the device. This is supported by more recent reports from DigiTimes, because we've heard this rumor for a while. The report says that Apple has been working closely with their Taiwanese partner, ASE Technology, to keep their sensor game up. They're kind of tweaking the sensors across the board for this next generation model. There's also been code in iOS 14 that points to the addition of the blood oxygen monitoring. What would happen is the watch would detect if your blood ox level drops below 95 to 100% saturation, and then it would notify the wearer that this could be a sign of a serious respiratory or cardiac problem. The reports seem to suggest that the feature might require a new hardware in the form of a new Series 6 Apple Watch, although it has been noted in the past that the feature could potentially be enabled for older devices. That's because if you remember way back when, iFixit noted that the sensors in the Apple Watch going all the way back to 2015 actually had the ability to monitor blood oxygen levels, although Apple has never seemed to enable the feature, even though they might technically be able to do so. So the the guess is that Apple possibly has been waiting for the features and the technology and the sensors to get better, and that they might be designing specific technology for the next generation Apple Watch to finally turn this feature on. So that'd be a little bit of disappointment, I think, for owners of older Apple Watches, but I think the idea of opting for better or more accurate technology is likely the way Apple would typically go, right? They like to kind of one up the competition rather than do what some of their other competitors are doing. And I bring this up because a lot of people have pointed out that there's some other devices on the market that are using similar sensors to Apple's current technology that do offer blood oxygen monitoring features. And it's always been a question, well, why hasn't Apple enabled this? And I really do think the answer is they're wanting to do it, you know, the Apple way, what they often consider to be the right way. And people might not always agree with that, but that seems to be the way to go. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is tied to the hardware in the Series 6 Apple Watch. Apple is doing a shakeup with their gift cards. Actually, I think they're finally fixing a problem that has been existing in gift cards for a while. And they're starting this at least in the US for now, but they do plan to roll it out to other countries. What they're doing is finally making gift cards work for everything. You may know that currently, Apple gift cards, you either buy them for the App Store and Apple Music and sort of online purchases, or you buy them for in-store purchases in the App Store or through Apple's online Apple Store. And you can't mix and match the two. So if you get a gift card for one, you have to only buy in that store. Well, they're changing that up now. The new gift cards will work for everything, including in-store and online, in-app, and with services and iCloud. So you get one card, it just goes into your account credit, and you can use that however you see fit. Now, old Apple Store cards are still going to work in the Apple Store only, but older App Store and iTunes cards can now go into your Apple account balance and can be used to buy Apple products, accessories, games, movies, TV shows, and more. So you'll be able to use those across the board moving forward. So that suddenly, in my mind, makes some of the deals on iTunes gift cards that you can get sometimes a lot more attractive, because that is a great way, you know, at Costco or whatever, they'll give you those bundles where you get $100 worth of gift cards for, say, $80, $85. So you get a significant discount, and it's a way to get discounts on Apple products, maybe now in-store, that you normally wouldn't get. And that sounds great for now, but it also might mean that Apple stops doing those kinds of discounts and promotions now that they have these everything cards. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, if we still see those deals or not. But I would have a feeling if you see one of those now, it might be a good time to pick one of them up. But nice to see Apple kind of, I really fixing a problem, I think, that was an issue, because people would buy the wrong card or think they were buying a card that could be used at the Apple Store and then it would only work on iTunes. That was definitely a frustrating experience. Apple may be looking to take the next step in their payment processing game by helping retailers. A Bloomberg report says that Apple has recently acquired mobile payment startup MobiWave for about $100 million. MobiWave was a company that developed an app and technology that allows any NFC-enabled smartphone to capture payments from NFC payment cards. Apple could be looking to expand Apple Pay options for retailers, and this would basically allow any iPhone to become a tap-to-pay terminal. We don't know if that's what Apple is planning to do with the technology. That's just speculation on mine and a few others' parts. Of course, Apple never comments on their purchases or plans for companies they acquire, so we really don't know what they're doing. We do know that Apple also acquired the talent from MobiWave, the entire team there, so it's safe to assume they're going to take those engineers and folks and have them help Apple expand their various Apple Pay and NFC initiatives. You know, I think it's interesting that Apple might be thinking about going up against somebody like Square or some of the other options out there. But when you think about the number of iPhones that are out and available, it seems like a really great way to go. I mean, if a retailer, especially a smaller retailer, wants to be able to take tap-to-pay payments and doesn't want to have to pay out for new terminals, they can simply take their iPhone, install an app, or even have something built into iOS that would allow them to take those payments, and immediately they can take Tap to Pay from Visa, MasterCard, or even like Apple Pay and Android Pay. So it's kind of a good move, and it'll be interesting to see where Apple might take the technology. There was a bit of bad news this week for Apple and the Secure Enclave chip that's in a number of their iPhones. That's because this week, Chinese hackers from the Panju team reported finding a security hole in the hardware related to the Secure Enclave. The flaw is actually in a memory controller that potentially lets hackers acquire data that would normally be viewed and used only by the Secure Enclave. That's the whole point of that part of Apple's processor, is to kind of protect personal data and information. That's where things like the fingerprint for Touch ID are stored. And the problem here is that because this flaw is actually in a read-only part of the hardware, it is unpatchable by Apple. The exploit was disclosed by the team at the Mobile Security Conference in Shanghai. It affects all Apple chips between the A7 and the A11 Bionic. The good news for us consumers is that the exploit would require physical access to your device, so the attack vectors are somewhat limited. It is noted that the issue cannot be used in a browser-based or app-based jailbreak attack, so it's not going to be hitting you remotely. That means really where this exploit will most likely come into play is and be a concern is for folks who are dealing with corporate espionage or nation-state hacking, or this could be the kind of thing that, say, someone like the FBI could use to potentially break into or get information off of a seized cell phone or device. So definitely a big deal, but day-to-day for us consumers, is it a concern? Probably likely not. And it has been patched in the A12 and A13 chips, so newer iPhones are not vulnerable to this exploit. And then finally in the news for this week, we'll round out with some Apple TV Plus news. It looks like Apple is making a lot of friends in Hollywood with their new Apple TV Plus service. I think a lot of this is coming on the back of the success of the Tom Hanks film, Greyhound. But this week, according to Deadline, Apple has signed another first look deal with Appian Way Productions, which is a film and television production company founded by actor Leonardo DiCaprio. Currently, Apple is already working with the company on two upcoming projects, a thriller starring Elizabeth Moss called Shining Girls, and also the Martin Scorsese film Killers of the Flower Moon, which will star DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. As you might have noticed, Apple has been picking up a lot of first looks lately, and that could give their Apple TV Plus service a leg up on the competition, because it means that they'll have first shot at projects coming from a list of many A-list directors, actors, and production companies. In addition to Appian Way, Apple has landed first look deals with A24, Idris Elba's Green Door Pictures, Ridley Scott's Scott Free Productions, and Justin Lin's Perfect Storm Entertainment, along with many others. So Apple is, I think making waves, and I think a lot of folks who maybe discounted Apple TV Plus early on are probably getting a little bit nervous because they seem to be gaining a lot of popularity. We'll have to see if these deals continue, but I imagine they will. Also this week, we heard that Apple inked a deal for a new detective drama series with Team Downey Productions, a company run by Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey. The series is based on a Toronto Life article called The Sting, written by the series co-producer Michael Lista. Adam Perlman is also serving as writer and executive producer, and Robert Downey Jr. is said to have a supporting role in the series. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you're looking to set up a web server, maybe for your business, maybe for personal reasons, a great place to do that is over at Linode. And that's because Linode makes it easy to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can get a server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and choice of 10 node locations. Best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit so you can try out the service. And it's definitely more than just hosting. With Linode, you have all the options and choices to build a server with the services and features you need. Whatever your requirements, you can build it on Linode. Dedicated CPUs, distributed applications, hosted services, websites, continuous integration environments, continuous delivery environments, they can handle it all. And all of their servers feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. Pricing is simple with no surprise fees. You pay just for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their cloud manager makes managing all that stuff, upgrading your plans, changing your Linodes, setting up new Linodes, super, super easy. It's an amazing control panel. I've used a lot of them, and Linodes is outstanding. So check out Linode. Get your $20 MacCast credit. Just visit Linode.com/MacCast to set up your first Linode. That's Linode.com/MacCast and get that $20 credit. And a huge thank you to Linode for their support of the show. I didn't realize it had been around this long, but apparently Apple's App Store app, the app you can use to buy things from the App Store, has turned 10. It's been around for 10 years, and over on Mac Rumors, they noted that the developers of the app put in a little Easter egg to kind of celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the app. I don't know how someone found this, but basically, if you go into the search in the App Store app and you type the search 10 years, you'll get balloons that pop up and sort of bounce around the screen. You can interact with them. You can tap on them and they'll inflate and pop, or you can double tap and they'll fly off the screen, or you can just wait for them to float up and fly away, and you get a little App Store celebration. So not, you know, a ground, earth-shattering new app feature or anything like that, but something that is always fun is to find little Easter eggs in apps, and so I thought I'd share that one with you here at the opening of the feedback section of the show. Let's get into some more serious questions from the community, though. I had Marco write in to me to express some frustration recently with the Messages app. Now, this isn't something particularly that has really bothered me, because I've always just viewed the Messages app as sort of transient, but I know more and more a lot of people use Messages almost like email, and a lot of people want to maybe manage it a little bit more like email. And Apple, of course, in iOS 14 is adding some new features to make things a little bit easier, but Marco was noting that the big trouble with Messages right now is that over the years, or maybe even if you're doing a lot of messaging, over the course of a couple months, you can start to build up a number of conversation threads, especially if you're doing a lot of group messaging. Maybe you're using it for business and personal reasons, and you can get a lot of message threads going, and you end up with this really big long list, and there's not a lot of tools or ways that you can really organize that. You might also not always be messaging with the same groups of people, so as you do that, you know, your message threads build up over time, and it can really start to clutter up the Messages app. Like I said, in iOS 14, Apple is adding features like conversations and pinned messages that can probably help, because you can put up to 9 of your sort of most recent or favorite messages kind of up at the top, but I don't know if that's really going to solve the problem that Marco is bringing up. Because the issue for Marco was that, unlike some other messaging apps, there's kind of no way to really organize or archive conversations. Basically, keep the conversations in the app, but kind of stash them away out of the main interface. You know, with email apps, we have folders, we have archive folders we can put things into. And his idea is, like, why can't we have kind of basically the same thing in messages? Yeah, you can go in and delete old message threads, but when you do that, you lose the entire conversation history, and you might want to save that stuff. You might want to go back and re-reference it, but you don't need to have those ongoing, those older conversations always there in your big messages list. And so he was asking, you know, if we should be sort of soliciting feedback to Apple to say, hey, can we get some additional features? And I'm sure they've heard some of this, but the idea would be if more of us are asking for it, Apple might pay a little bit more attention. And so I wanted to throw it out to the community and see how you guys feel about this. You know, is this something that bothers you? Or more importantly, how do you deal with old messages or archiving messages and those sorts of things? You know, I know you can go into the app, and if you want to adjust the settings for the keep messages settings, of course, you can set it to 30 days, 1 year, or forever. But again, the only thing that's going to do is help kind of keep things auto cleaned up, and it's going to do it by deleting your message threads. And the idea here is, how do you preserve your older threads and be able to come back and reference them, still keep them around, but not have them cluttering up the main interface in messages? And like I said, I haven't used iOS 14 extensively yet, so I don't know if some of the new features like pinned messages are going to help this, but I kind of get a feeling that they won't. Now, I'm not just going to ask the question here. Of course, I'm going to throw out one of my ideas to the community, which is, I know one way that you can kind of clean up your messages is to export them using a tool like iMazing. iMazing will let you go in and save your messages out of the Messages app. Unfortunately, though, the options are only to kind of move it into like a PDF or a text record, so you could store that on your Mac, but it's not really going to be in the Messages app anymore, and you can't go back and bring messages and messages threads back in. So you can kind of keep a history, you can keep a backup or an archive in a way, but it's not the same thing, I don't think, that Marco is talking about. So, you know, do you think the idea of a message archive in Messages would be a good feature to have? Are there other features that you'd like to see Apple bring to Messages? And again, should we be maybe soliciting to have this be changed or updated? You know, I think, again, if you look to email, which is, you know, kind of starting to show its age. You know, I use email a lot, but I'm an older guy. Younger folks, I think, are using Messages more and more and messaging apps. So maybe messaging apps, especially Apple's app, need to grow up a little bit and become a little bit more sophisticated in terms of their management. I think Apple's done a great job of adding a lot of fun features to Messages, but I'm not so sure they're thinking about the utility of Messages going forward. And maybe they should be thinking about that a little bit more. So I thought this was a great topic of conversation for Marco to bring up. So Marco, thank you for bringing this to our attention, and I look forward to hearing what you and the community have to say about this one. Another great question that I received this week came from Robin via an email, looking for a recommendation on an app that would easily lock and hide a folder on the Mac. So basically, secure a folder and keep it away from prying eyes. And Robin was looking in the Mac App Store to see if there were some apps there, but noted that a lot of them, while there were apps, had really bad reviews. And this has generally been my experience on the Mac App Store. Let's be honest, the Mac App Store, and even the App Store, is kind of a mess, right? You go in there, and there's a lot of garbageware. There's just a lot of throwaway apps that look like they're written by shady or weird sort of sweat house app development teams from all over the place, you know, and then just they look like they're just cranking out junk, right? And you get a lot of that, especially in these utility kind of apps. And so it's really hard to discern what's a good one or what's a bad one. And so Robin was looking for recommendations, and my first thought immediately went to an app from the folks at MacPaw, which was amazing, called Hider. And I think the last version was called Hider 2, and it did exactly this. You could give it a folder or a file, and then it would encrypt it and also allow you to hide it on the Mac. Unfortunately, it looks like that app was discontinued in 2019, so it doesn't exist anymore. Now, MacPaw does have a current app called Encrypto, but this one will just do half of what Robin is asking for. It will encrypt files or folders. It looks like it does it very nicely, and you can share them, and it's got a lot of great features. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but that's not what the question is. The question is there an app that will do locking a folder, basically password protecting a folder, and then hiding it? And you know, my solution for this, Robin, has been natively on the Mac to use Diskutility. I've talked about this a little bit, but basically to set up a sparse bundle disk image that's encrypted. And so that handles the encryption part. It's pretty easy to do, although it's not as easy as just like throwing a folder or, you know, pointing a folder at an app and having it do all the stuff for you. You do have to do a little bit of the work manually. But basically, you open up Diskutility. You go under the file menu, choose new image and new blank image, and then you need to give it a name and a format, either APFS or probably macOS Extended Journal, depending upon what you're doing. You give it a size, and in this case, you want to give it the largest size you think you'll ever want it to be. Now, don't worry about it using up that much storage on your Mac, because the way a sparse bundle works is it will only use up as much as you have stored in it. So even if you tell it, you know, I want a, 10 megabyte container, and you only put 1 megabyte in there, it's only going to use up 1 megabyte of space. The caveat, though, is that you'll only ever be able to store up to 10 megabytes in there. So think of it as sort of creating a virtual, you know, floppy disk in a way. I mean, that's kind of an ancient reference at this point, but you get the idea, right? Is you're going to create a container of a certain size that you can store things in, and it's almost like an external, except that it's on a file. You know, it's on a file that's stored on your system. So it will only use up as much space on your system as you have stuff in there. So, you know, just think about what you're going to be putting in there and make sure you set up the right size from the beginning, because you can't really go back and change them. Of course, you could always make a new bundle if one got full and just transfer everything over to it, you know, copy from one to another. But just something to think about as you're setting it up. So pick the size, and then you need to set the image format, the format for the image, to sparse disk image. And like I said, that means it's only going to use as much space as is stored in the image. And then finally, the encryption part, you're going to choose under encryption the encryption level that you want, either 128 or 256, and then it will prompt you for a password. And you need to enter that password. You want to set up a good secure one, and you want to make sure that you can remember it. So I would advise using a password manager like 1Password or LastPass, storing it in there, and then encrypting your disk image with that password. You can also choose to generate and store it in Apple's Keychain as well. But if you ever forget that password, because it's an encryption password, you won't be able to open your disk image and you'll never get your data back. It'll be lost forever. So it's really important when you're setting up or working with encryption that you remember your password. So you cannot, there's no forgot password. There's no way around it. You've just lost your data if you lose your password. So that's an important thing to know. But you do all that, and then what'll happen is you'll end up with a sparse disk image file on your Mac. You double-click that, it will prompt you for the password so that it can decrypt and mount that volume, and then you can just copy your files into it. And what's nice, again, when you first mount it and enter the password, it'll ask if you want to put that in your macOS keychain, and if you store it in your keychain, then you'll be able to open that bundle or mount that disk image whenever you want, just by being logged into your Mac. And then when you unmount that image, it'll be re-encrypted. And if anybody was to ever get that file, they wouldn't be able to open it without the password. They wouldn't be able to get at the data. There's no way to crack it. Or I shouldn't say no way, but it's virtually impossible to be able to crack it. So that's one way natively to at least handle the encryption part. And then for the hiding part, there's also a native way to do that. A lot of people don't know that if you simply put a period at the beginning of a file name or a folder name, it will hide it on your Mac. Now, the Finder, in its sort of native state, won't let you do this. If you try it, it will actually warn you and say that files or folders named with a dot in front of them are reserved for the system. But there is a little trick in the latest Mac OS versions that you can use to get around that. And that is, in the Finder, if you type Command Shift Period, it will show you all of the invisible files, the files and folders that have file names starting with a period on your Mac. You need to be careful when you use this because, again, a lot of the system files use this naming convention to sort of hide themselves from the user so you can't, you know, wreak havoc on your system. So you don't want to remove, delete, or change any of the hidden files or folders that you see when you activate this command. But when you activate this command, what you can do is you can take a folder that you want to hide. So say you create a folder called secret, you hit command shift period, and then you change that name of secret to dot secret. That will create it or set it up as a hidden folder. And then when you type command shift period again, that folder will not be seen in the Finder until you activate the command again so that you can see hidden files. So pretty simple way to hide files on the Mac, files or folders, and you could do this with your new disk image. So the combo here would get you where you wanted. You could create that secure disk image with encryption, and then you could change that secure disk image name to have a period in front of it, and then just access it using this keyboard shortcut command. So that is a way to get what you want. Obviously not the easiest way, but it would work. You also have many other options for just storing encrypted text and data. So if you don't care so much about the hiding part, but you just need to, you know, maybe write down some passwords that you want to store encrypted in a file, there's a few ways you can do that on the Mac natively. You can password protect a notes file in the Notes app. So you could simply create a new note and use password protection on that. You can create secure notes in a password application like 1Password and store them securely there. You can even add secure notes into the Keychain Access app that's built into your Mac. So the thing that normally stores your web passwords and your app, your passwords on your Mac, yeah, you can open up that in utilities and you can add a new secure note there and store information there. So there's other places where you can kind of store this information, but I'm curious if there's something out there that maybe I missed or I'm not aware of, and maybe the community can help us out, Robin. So I'm guessing maybe there's an app that was like, you know, Hider and Hider 2 that makes this whole process easy and one that's good and can be trusted and doesn't look shady on the Mac App Store. And if you are the person who knows about that, please send me an email, shoot us an audio comment or a review to maccast@gmail.com, and we'll share that out on a future episode. But Robin, hopefully my tip maybe gives you a workaround for now. You can look into some of these other apps. And again, I'm not really sure what you're trying to protect or encrypt, but there's some options. And hopefully the community will have some new ones for us. And then finally this week, Donald wrote in with a dilemma that I have too myself run across on occasion. Donald has a Mac set up in his house and he has music on it, like many of us do in his music library. In his case, it's on an iMac and he likes to access that remotely using the music app and home sharing. And if you've ever used home sharing before, you know that the trouble with it is that for it to work with the music app or iTunes, whichever Mac your library is installed on needs to have iTunes or the music app open and running. And as you might imagine, it's easy to accidentally quit the app or forget to launch it, and you go to access your music from an iOS device or remotely, and boom, you can't access it. And it can be a hassle, especially if your Mac is far away across the house or maybe on another floor, to have to go all the way to the Mac, boot it up just to access the music from your iOS device or remotely from another room. And so he was asking, you know, is there a way or a simple way to actually remotely launch the music app from an iOS app? Or why can't, you know, probably even more importantly, why hasn't Apple figured out a way that, you know, my Mac's on the same network as my iPhone, why don't I just have a button on the remote app or in there to launch iTunes? Or better yet, if I try to access home sharing, why doesn't it just know to just, hey, I need to launch iTunes? And maybe it's a security issue. Seems like there would be a way around that. You know, you could sort of set up some sort of permissions or some sort of pairing connection that you opt into and you know that it's going on. But We really don't have that. And so he was asking, you know, is there a way to do this? And immediately my first thought went to remote access, right? There are a lot of ways with your Mac to set up remote login using SSH or remote access or screen sharing using VNC. And then you could use apps like Prompt or Screens on the iPhone to remotely control and log into the iMac and then launch iTunes. And this is all built in, right? You can go into System Preferences, you can go under Sharing, and you have a couple different options. If you want to do screen sharing or the VNC option, you can click on the computer settings. You can check the, you know, well, first you click on screen sharing, you turn it on, and then you click the computer settings button, and then you need to check on VNC and then set a VNC password. And again, you want to make sure that's a good, secure password. And if you prefer just to use a terminal command line, you could turn on remote login in the sharing preferences. And that's basically SSH, secure shell. And then you can set up the permissions. And in all cases, you want to make sure that you set up the accounts that would have access. You want to limit them to only your user accounts. And you want to make sure all your security is set up and good. So, you know, you're going to be mostly okay there because you're in theory only accessing it locally from your home network. It does assume that your network is secure, that you haven't gone in and opened any of the external ports for remote screen sharing or VNC. So those should all be locked down and secure. Your Wi-Fi should also have a very good secure Wi-Fi password because, again, anyone on your home network would in theory have access to these services running on your iMac. So you really want to lock it down with good accounts, good account passwords, and good Wi-Fi security and Wi-Fi passwords. But assuming you have that, it's relatively safe to turn this feature on. And then once it's turned on, that the interface will show you the IP address or the network addresses that you need to plug in either into your VNC client application that you would run on your iOS device or your SSH application that you'd run on your iOS device to access your Mac locally. And it's going to be a local IP address. Again, we're not talking about opening it up anywhere outside of your home network. Of course, you could do that, but that opens up all new kinds of security issues that you need to worry about. And that's a little bit more than we need to get into for this scenario, because again, Donald's just looking to have a way to launch a app remotely on his Mac. And so what's cool about the SSH option or the remote login option is there's a simple command you can give from the command line to open any application on your Mac. And you basically type open and then space dash A for application and then space the name of the application. And you can do this in the terminal on your Mac right now. So if you opened up the terminal and you typed open space dash A space music with a capital M and hit enter, it will open and launch the music app just like you had clicked it on, you know, in the Finder or from the applications folder or from the dock, you know, wherever it might be. So that's an easy way. You could, you know, turn on remote login. You could install the Prompt app for SSH. There's a lot of terminal and SSH apps you can get for iOS. I like Prompt from Panic for VNC screen sharing. I like Screens. I'll have links to both of those in the show notes at maccast.com. But you open up your SSH, you type in the address that was in the remote login dialog when you turned that on in System Preferences in the sharing. You can plug that in, and then once you have logged in remotely to that Mac, you just issue that terminal command, open-a music, and the music app will launch remotely on that iMac. Of course, with VNC, you'll be able to see the screen, and you can just simply go in and click on and open up the music app. So that was one way you could do it. Again, obviously, it's built in, it's native, you don't need any additional apps other than the few on iOS, but it is a little bit complicated. Another thing you might want to do is make sure that the music app is set up and added to your login items on the iMac. That way, every time you start the iMac, it would automatically open up the music app and it would be running. And as long as you never quit it and the Mac is still on and running, you should have access to it. So to do that, you just go into the System Preferences, go into Users and Groups, select the account that you use, and then click on Login Items. And then you can click on the little plus, go to the applications folder, select the music app, and add it to the list of login items. And anything in that list will automatically launch when you boot your Mac. And then if you're not turning your Mac on every day, you could also go in to use the energy saver preferences and the scheduling options to have your Mac turn on and shut down at certain times of the day so that you make sure it's always on and available for your music. So between those two things, you could make sure that you know, most of the time the music app is always running. So those are some options. Again, a little bit of a hassle, and I recognize that, not as easy as just having an application. So I decided, you know, maybe somebody has figured this out. Maybe there is an app out there on the App Store, and maybe there is a good one. So I did a little poking around. I did some searching, and I found an app called Remote Control for Mac Pro. And I think it's from Sherpake, C-H-E-R-P-A-K-E. Not sure if that's how you pronounce it, but it does allow you to basically install a little free companion app. So it's an iOS app, a paid for iOS app, and I would get the pro version because it's just a one-time payment. They also have a light version, but you would need to do in-app purchase to access some additional features, and I don't think it's very expensive, especially if you need this kind of functionality. But I tried it out. I did download it. I tried it out on my Mac, and it worked great. Now, when you install the Helper app, because of how macOS security is, you do need to set up a bunch of permissions in the security system, allowing it to have basically remote access to be able to do keyboard commands and a bunch of other things. And so you are opting in to allow this software to kind of take control of your Mac. But once you've done that, and it does a good job sort of walking you through the permissions that you set up, once you've done that, this app sits up in the menu bar, it runs in the background, and then with the iOS app, what you can do is see your Macs on the network that are running the Helper app, and you can basically control everything on that Mac, including it has a section just for launching apps. And so once the app is running, you just connect to the iMac, then you go into the apps section of the app, and any app, it'll just have a list almost like the Launchpad list, you know, all the little icons. You just find the music app, you tap on it, boom, it opens up the app. You can also quit apps. You can control all the functions of your Mac. You can put it to sleep. You can activate screensavers. You can wake up from screensavers. You can shut down the Mac remotely. You can launch applications. You can type commands. You can, it's even Apple scriptable. Like it does a lot of stuff. And it's only, the pro version of the app is $6.99. The light version is free, like I said, but it has in-app purchase. So for $7, you basically get the functionality I think that you're looking for, Donald. And that's a small investment. If this is a big hassle for you, I think it's probably worth spending the $7 and setting this up. Or you can go the free route and do the remote access like I was talking about. But those were some ways that I thought you could handle this situation. I'm sure those of you in the community might have some additional suggestions. Maybe there's a simpler app or a different combination of apps that I'm not aware of. If you do know about that, shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can get more information, details on all their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to find me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or MacCast on Instagram. That is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.